Welcome to Hard Talk on the BBC World Service. I'm Sarah Montague. In 1989, five African American and Latino teenagers were accused of attacking and raping a woman jogging in New York's Central Park. The case became notorious, with the then property tycoon Donald Trump taking out ads in four newspapers saying, "Bring back the death penalty," even before their trial was held. All five were convicted and served years in prison before being exonerated when another man admitted to the crime. One of the five was Yusuf Salam. When he was in jail, he resolved to emerge better, not bitter, and he's now a poet and activist for reforming the prison and justice systems. But as anti-racism protests continue over the police shootings of African Americans and fears of more unrest to come, is meaningful change even more distant now than in the America of his youth? Yusuf Salam joins me now. Welcome to Hard Talk. Take us back and tell us what happened on the night of the 19th of April in 1989.
What happened was young people hanging out in the park, a park that they looked at as their backyard. And all of a sudden, we fast forward to the evening, further in the evening, and then the next day, and we were accused of raping a white woman in Central Park, a rape that had not been seen by any one of us. And we were vilified from the beginning because we were looked at as criminals because of the color of our skin and not the content of our character. They quickly made a case against us and said that we were the ones who did this. And as you can imagine, we were horrified as we begin to be run over by the spike wheels of justice. And then as we look into the future, 13 years go by, and then the truth comes out. And the truth shatters everything that the system had made the people believe.
Okay, well, let's talk through that night, though, because, I mean, it was an extraordinary night with the number of attacks in Central Park. And you were, what, I think, with a group of your friends in the park that night?
Actually, the only person that I knew in the group was Corey Wise. And we all went into the park thinking that we were just going to be hanging out. It was young people hanging out with older people. And as you can imagine, that's something that usually never happens. You know, most of the times when you're a young person, if you have older siblings and your mother or father says, "Hey, you can go outside, but you got to take your younger brother or sister with you," there's this desire not to want them to be with you. But in this particular case, it was young people hanging out with older people for the first time. And we thought it would be cool to see what it was like and what made those people so cool. And of course, one thing led to another. And almost all of us who were not involved in any of the mayhem in the park were like deers caught in headlights as we began to witness the terrible things that were going on. People being beaten up, people being robbed, people being assaulted. There were actually individuals who were convicted of those crimes that never became known as who we were known back then, the Central Park Five. They were convicted of those crimes. They were individuals that were picked out of lineups and went to prison for those crimes. And yet the system still looked at those of us who became known as the Central Park Five as being guilty of everything that happened in the park that night.
And the particular case, though, at the centre of this was of a woman, Tricia Maley, 28-year-old white woman, who'd gone jogging and was very brutally beaten up and raped and not expected to live.
Absolutely. I think that that really became the crux of the matter, because if you can imagine, in American history, in American criminal history, we have been witnessing that any time a person is accused of rape, even back to the time of Emmett Till, where they said that he had whistled at a white woman, anytime they cry, we die. And so the story of lynching in America and the story of legal lynching in America oftentimes is predicated on the premise of a lie.
Let's go back, though, because the police took you in the next day. The five of you made confessions. Yours wasn't videotaped, but four were. Why did you confess to the police?
I actually did not confess to the police. That's a misnomer that has been out there that the police are pushing out. And they want that misnomer to be out there because they want to have the public imagine that we who were victimized are the ones who were part of our own victimization.
What happened when you were in the police station? How did they treat you and what did they do?
It was one of the most horrible things that you can imagine. Here we were, 14, 15, and 16-year-old children. I was picked up the next evening, where Raymond Santana and Kevin Richardson were picked up the night of April 19th, 1989. Their interrogation started that evening My interrogation started the very next evening along with Corey Wise. And as they began to question me, I would hear them beating Corey Wise up in the next room. He was 16 years old, by the way. I was not supposed to be interrogated without a parent, but because he was 16 in American judicial system, the 16-year-old is adultified and therefore responsible for themselves. The problem with that is that he had a lower capacity to understand. And so his mental capacity may have been, say, still in the fifth grade, sixth grade, seventh grade, even though he was 16 years old. But they would beat him up and then they would come back in the room that I was in and tell me that I was next. All the while, they were asking me, tell us what happened in the park. And I would tell them everything that I saw, everything that I remembered happening. And then I would say, and then I left and we hopped the train and came home. And they would get so frustrated with me because in their minds, I was concealing something. And the truth of the matter was that we weren't concealing anything. We didn't know anything about a woman that had been raped in Central Park. Nobody had any drops of blood on them. Nobody's DNA was at the scene of the crime. Nothing from the woman was on us. They had made the public believe that Kevin Richardson had been scratched in an altercation by the female jogger. But yet when they looked under her fingernails, there was no forensic evidence to point to that falsification.
So much seemed to rest on these confessions, though. And the one of the prosecutors in the case said that this was not an Alabama jail where two guys who'd been partners for years put a guy in a back room and he doesn't see the light of day for 3 years. She makes the point that three of the five went home and had a night's sleep before they were taken into custody. Nobody under 16 was talked to until a parent or guardian arrived.
It sounds like a fairy tale. It sounds like a fairy tale. And I say that because if you can imagine, like if you've seen the documentary, The Central Park Five by Ken Burns, one of the most beautiful things that happens in that particular documentary by which we get our voices back is that you hear Raymond Santana stating what he said in his false confession. And his false confession begins something like this. At approximately 1900 hours, me and a group of my friends began to walk south. And then he looks up and he says, what 14-year-old boy talks like this? This is what they had the public believe, that this 14-year-old boy had the capacity to say at 1900 hours, me and a group of my friends began to walk south. We don't even talk like that. But the public thought this was beautiful. This was a sealed case. The confession sealed the deal, and therefore there was no need to look at them as innocent until proven guilty.
Well, let's talk about the public atmosphere at the time, because you've told a story recently of where your mother, who was a professor at Parsons University, was coming home from work when a police car goes past, and with the megaphones blaring, that's her, that's the mother of that dog, Yusuf Salaam.
Yes, indeed. This is afterwards. And we were getting death threats. We were getting all kind of hate mail. And, you know, it was predicated really on the heels of what Donald Trump placed in the New York City newspapers at the time. 2 weeks after we were accused, he had already created an ad that was going to be run full page in all of New York City's major newspapers. And that ad essentially was calling for our deaths. It simply said, bring back the death penalty. Bring back our police.
Do you think it made a difference? Because you were tried in front of a jury. Do you think that ad, which was in four newspapers, made a difference to the way that they saw the case?
Absolutely. In America, we are not seen as full human beings. In America, when they talk about to protect and serve, they are not talking about the people who have been pushed to the margins of society. Because when it comes to Black and brown folks, we are the ones whose rights are continuously trampled upon. We've just seen that expression happen just recently in Louisville, where Breonna Taylor's murderer is still not being charged with the murder.
I'll come back to that in a minute, but let's stay with your story, because there you were, 15-year-old boy, going through the courts. Before you were convicted, did you think that you would be found innocent?
Absolutely. I had not yet been awakened to the fullness of what the American nightmare is about, as described as Malcolm X. You know, here we were going through this court system, and I wholeheartedly believed that the system would find out that we didn't do this. Years later, one of the jurors was on CNN with Raymond Santana. And he essentially was saying something very similar to what we were experiencing in the interrogation rooms. He said he was going crazy. Once they got the charge that they were to deliberate and to figure out whether we were guilty or innocent, he said he was going crazy. He knew that we hadn't done this, but there was so much pressure to vote guilty that he found some cockamamie excuse, in his own words. He found some cockamamie excuse to vote guilty just so that he can get out of there. And I think that that's a sad reality of the criminal justice system, that you are being pushed into a space where it's no longer about truth, but it's more so about who can tell the best story. And so when the verdicts came down and we lost in a very, very powerful and sad way, it was the most horrible thing that we could imagine, because I had up until that moment believed that the criminal system was just, but I found out that it was the criminal system of injustice.
What, you remember that moment, the moment you were sentenced?
I do, because I was free. I was going back and forth to court. I was on bail. And so I was free to go back home every single evening after the court proceedings had finished. And yet that moment, instead of getting the opportunity to go back home, I was handcuffed, led into the back. I wasn't even given the opportunity to hug my loved ones. My mother wasn't even in the courtroom because she had been barred from the courthouse, and I wasn't able to give them a hug. They led us into the back, and we began to serve hard time.
Serve hard time. How did you cope with prison?
Prison, in many ways, is a place where either you do the time or you let time do you. I read a poem in prison early on, and it simply said, prison life in many ways can be likened to the womb. If the life inside becomes stillborn, the womb becomes the tomb. It was about fighting. It was about trying to do everything in your capacity to remain free in your mind, even though your body was in bondage. And so I prayed often. I read widely. I drew immensely. And I also meditated. And while I was in prison, even though I wasn't able to see the outside as freely as someone who was free, I had to imagine it. And through my imagination, I was able to make myself go where my mind was taking me.
There were so many challenges to you as a result of what happened, but one was particularly with your friend, Corey Wise, because I think he was only there to accompany you, and he was the one who ended up with a much longer sentence. He was slightly older, and he ended up doing 12 years in jail.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think that the fullness of how he internalized that could not be fully understood without seeing When They See Us. You know, part four of When They See Us really painted the picture.
Let me just explain. When You See Us is a Netflix series that was made about the story, and it was on 2019 and won many awards. But I wonder, you talk about you can understand the story when you see that. Are the two of you still friends?
We are. We are, actually. If you Google both our names, you'll find that we were recently on The Breakfast Club. We're still friends. We still call each other. We still text each other. You know, this journey has created a sacred brotherhood. The only two of us that knew each other were Corey and I, and everyone else we met in prison. But all of us are brothers.
So you leave prison. It is then and only then that somebody comes forward and says they were responsible for it. What was that moment like? Because, I mean, you talk as if there still is a cloud hanging over you. But surely that is the moment it must have been lifted.
You know, when we look at the juxtaposition of when they found out we were innocent to when they thought we were guilty, it is an overwhelming reality that the beginning of our case was a tsunami. There were over 400 articles written about us ripping apart our lives. Nobody came to us and asked us anything, but yet people were describing for the public who and what we were. 13 years later, when the truth came out, it was a whisper my mother described in City Hall. It was a whisper she wondered if the rats in New York City had heard. There was little to no fanfare. There was a cloud of suspicion that had laid in the minds of the people. Because, see, all throughout our case, they would say things like DNA evidence. But But yet when the DNA came back and it didn't match any one of us, that quickly was swept under the rug. And so when people moved forward with this case, and especially the prosecutors and the people that were there to judge us, those individuals forgot that the fallacy of this case allowed them to move forward and overstep the bounds of justice. They overstepped the bounds of the law. And in many ways, they were complicit, because a life that has been snatched can never be fully repaired. We were 14, 15, and 16-year-old children, and I think that that's the part that has to be magnified, because now we came back out and we were adults without the toolkit properly to properly maneuver ourselves in the day's world. You know, and it's still a challenge. It's still a lot of confusion around it, because Donald Trump, becoming the president of the United States, still says, well, they had to be guilty of something. The police had so much evidence against them.
But so we're talking about events back in the 90s when you were released. Here we are in 2020. There have been nationwide protests since the killing of George Floyd by police. And you mentioned Breonna Taylor. She's the 26-year-old who was shot dead in her home. We just heard a grand jury will be indicting one officer for his role, but there's no charges going to be brought against the two officers who shot her. Is that a form of justice? I mean, are you prepared to accept that there may be other charges that will be brought, but that this was, that they should be effectively cleared?
When we heard the attorney general describe what was going on, and I'm talking about that night that Breonna Taylor lost her life, when we heard him describe the activities of that night, it sounded as if he was given a play-by-play of a game or a football or some type of sporting event. And it was really a sad moment, because what I knew and the world got an opportunity to see in a very real way is that this was institutional protectionism. And I think that that's the hardest part to swallow. We always talk and speak to the heart, like the humanity of us as a people. But America right now has turned savage when we look at the criminal justice system.
But you've been campaigning on this ever since you were released on reform of the police. Is the world, the criminal justice system, no different now than it was in the 90s?
It absolutely is no different. It's no different than it was when it was first imagined by the founding fathers. The system we thought was broken and in need of repair. And then we found out that it's working exactly as it was designed, that it's not broken, that the system is operating and it's alive and sick as opposed to being alive and well. And so it used to be, as we were protesting and crying out, that we were thinking about things in a manner like to put a Band-Aid on something, and that Band-Aid would have been reform. But right now, the heartbeat of America is crying out in the streets. The ancestors' wildest dreams have been saying it's no longer about reform. It's about abolition.
Abolition? What do you mean? Explain. How you're proposing what? The abolition of the justice system, or replacing it with what?
I'm saying that we the people, that is found in the founding documents of American Constitution, was never inclusive of black and brown folks. We were considered three-fifths of a human being. We are still considered three-fifths of a human being. Many of us have been relegated to second-class citizenship, which is no citizenship. And we see that play out time and time again through the criminal justice system. They
what
want
you're
us-
saying is needed to address that.
What's needed is that we need to completely tear down what is in place and allow people who have been placed on the margins of society purposefully to be included in the process of how we move forward. And that moving forward cannot be imagined in a 5 or 10 year plan, but we need to imagine what it would look like generations from now, that we did something important in our lifetime that changed the trajectory of the criminal system of injustice in America to a system that was about fairness, that was about inclusion, That was about true justice. That was about equal rights.
But how are you getting from one to the other, can I ask? How are you seeing that happen?
It is incremental, and it is about us doing everything that we should be doing. A part of it, a large part of it, is participating in the current process, but not and never ever losing, never ever taking our eyes off of the prize. Because see, sometimes when we get into the system, we participate and then we become comfortable and we think that we've made some strides. And then all of a sudden, we are snapped back to reality. That reality that we are in the American nightmare and not the American dream. Because if we were living the American dream, everybody would be afforded true freedom, justice, and equality.
So what happens if Donald Trump gets another 4 years as president and remains in the White House after November?
I think that we have to prepare ourselves for the... We should hope for the best, and we should be prepared for the worst. And more importantly, as I was alluding to, it's not about a 5-year plan, a 10-year plan. It's about a generational plan. And so if we begin to really understand what's at stake, we begin to understand that it's about us organizing. It's about us unifying. They don't care. And by they, I mean the system of oppression does not care whether we cry out in the streets, whether we march, and whether we protest. What they do care about is whether we organize ourselves in a manner that's meaningful. You have a large majority of people who cannot use their voting rights because they've been placed by the margins of society. They've been granted second-class citizenship.
Can I just be clear? The organizing that you're talking about is organizing to get people to vote.
No, I'm not just talking about that. I'm talking about the total strategy. It has to be inclusive of voting because that's what we are dealing with right now. And so if we don't participate in the current process, non-participation is participation. We have to look at what we have, and then we have to imagine and then reimagine what it would take to live in a world where we are talking about the total inclusion of the kaleidoscope of the family, of the human family, right? And so if we're looking at the totality of the human family being able to walk in the dream that Dr. King imagined as an example, then we're talking about complete inclusion. We're not talking about white supremacy.
And in one word, will that happen in your lifetime?
I think that we will see incremental changes, but I think that it's more important for us to be the seed and for us to provide the water so that that can happen, perhaps in our lifetime, but definitely our children's and definitely in their children's lifetime.
Yusuf Salam, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Kim Chaganetsa from The Comb Podcast, where we unpick a single African story every week. If you have a look at our feed, you'll find stories about why it's difficult for young single women in Nigeria to find somewhere to live, or how we might stop building racist computer systems, and even stories of people losing religion and embracing new spiritual beliefs. That's The Comb from the BBC World Service, an enormous range of fascinating stories brought to you by the BBC African Newsroom. If you want to find out what we get up to next, search for The Comb, C-O-M-B, wherever you get your podcasts.